Support for the BTPM NPR What's Next podcast comes from Health Foundation for Western and Central New York, partnering with the community to pursue racial and socioeconomic health equity. Learn more at hfwcny.org.
From Buffalo, Toronto Public Media, this is What's Next, an hour dedicated to amplifying the voices of marginalized and underrepresented communities across Western New York and Southern Ontario.
We cannot erase, we cannot reform, we cannot make things better if we're uncomfortable having tough conversations,
absolutely,
if we're uncomfortable
absolutely
talking about race.
What's Next carries forward our mission to engage in meaningful conversations about race, equity, and the shared concerns that deeply affect Buffalo's East Side and beyond.
Don't stop. Make those families part of your life. Their lives are part of yours. Don't stop.
Together, we dive into the real issues, striving for understanding, connection, and change.
In the suburban area, everywhere, we must work and teach our children.
Today's conversation includes discussion of sexual abuse, grooming, trauma, and suicide. If you need support, call or text 988 for the Suicide and Crisis Lifeline, or contact the RAIN National Sexual Assault Hotline at 800-656-4673. This is What's Next from Buffalo, Toronto Public Media, NPR. I am your host for today, executive producer Charles Gilbert. And June is Men's Mental Health Awareness Month. I feel though as if I'm always being on this show at this time of year because this is a subject matter that holds near and dear to my heart. Today's conversation is about what men carry, what men survive, and what it takes to heal from things that many men are taught to bury. My guest is none other than author of Dash Krista. I got it
you
right.
Got it right this time. You got it. Nailed it.
Tawan T.J. Williams. It is a memoir and a healing guide for adult male survivors of sexual abuse. His story speaks to grooming, silence, shame, survival, addiction, incarceration, rebirth, faith, identity, and purpose. TJ, welcome.
Good to be back. Good to see you again, Charles.
Yes. We have had this conversation before on another platform of my personal one, but I wanted to get you on here to talk about your book and talk about just your story behind that. So as I did previously in our other conversation, I'm gonna ask you the same thing. You know, I do my check-in.
Yes.
And how are you doing from a scale 1 to 5 on the business level, personal, and your mental health? So how are you doing on those?
I'll go 4s across the board. Like I said, there's always room for growth. You can't ever say you're a 5. No, you know, but doing pretty well in every aspect.
Now, who exactly is TJ Tawan Williams?
That's sort of what the subject of the book was, right? To find that that identity, to see who actually I am and what that is defined as. And it's come to find out that I'm a leader, right? Like I'm a person who likes to step in and do very difficult things and say the difficult thing and try to lead the way or pave the way forward for people who may not have necessarily thought that there was a path forward for them.
Now, before we got on, me and you were talking and you had said that you just found out last year that June is Men's Mental Health Month. So with that being said, when you hear that Men's Mental Health Month, what does that mean to you personally?
It means opportunity. It means an opportunity to be able to say the things and have the conversations that a lot of us avoid. You know, one of the things I found from writing the book and the subject matter was that a lot of men in general shy away from not necessarily having the conversation, but publicly having the conversation about the things that have impacted them. And I think this gives us an opportunity to lay those things out and give people a safe space to speak their truth.
I do agree with that. I always feel though as if men do carry a lot of burden on them and they do suffer in silence. Mm-hmm. Your book is centered on healing. Do you think men are getting better at talking about mental health, or are we still learning?
We're still learning. There's a long way to go. Recently, I heard some comments from you know, Dana White is an example, or even Kevin Garnett talking about Victor Wembanyama, you know, after the game, where there's still these stigmas attached to expression of emotion, seeking help and counsel, dealing with, you know, the issues that you may be facing as a man, because we're all talking, man up. Mm-hmm. You know, we hear that from a very young age, man up, say it with your chest, right?
So yeah.
I think we still have, I think we're exposing, but we still have a very long way to go before I think the comfort level's there to express these things.
Now, you did bring up basketball, and you brought up the whole Kevin Garnett, what he said about Victor. Why do you think that we still have that stigma? Like, we still have to, there's still that overarching.
I think part of the problem is the idea of what a man is, right? This construct, the Superman that we've built, that none of us are, and it doesn't exist. And so there's this ideology of, you know, or this idol that we're supposed to be that no one can actually live up to. But we point to that all the time, right? Like, oh, you know, this is what a man does and this is what a real man is. And secretly, a lot of us don't have those. We're all missing elements of that. And I think that sort of leads to the frustration and self-loathing that takes place as a man.
And for the most part, men are often taught to survive.
Yes.
But they're not taught how to
actually live.
Live and how to heal.
Heal, right.
Yes. Do you think men are taught to hide their pain before they're ever taught to how to process?
Yeah. It's passed down. It's almost like an oral tradition, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, the patriarch tells the youth, this is how you're supposed to live. And we carry these things on with us generationally. You know, and a lot of us deal with a lot of baggage that we should be able to offload in a constructive way, but don't have the feeling of safety to be able to express those things, right? Like, for example, why is it that 80% of men commit suicide, right? 50% of the population, but 80% of suicides are men. Because there's no space to express those emotions, those traumas, those pain points without feeling like you're less of a man. So I think that's, you know, trying to bury that, it always resurfaces.
What made you want to go and write this book?
There was a conversation I had, and I talk about it in the book, where, you know, a friend said to me, you weren't in a relationship, right? You were the victim of a child predator. And so to sort of backtrack a bit, one of the conversations I had even after writing the book was with one of my coworkers, or actually an employee of mine. We're in Chicago, we're having lunch, and I'm telling him about the subject matter. And he said, well, I mean, that's not bad. She made a man out of you. You know, she taught you how to be a man. And that was the idea that I'd carried with me for most of my life, right? That
mm-hmm.
I was in this relationship, that I had somehow, as a teenager, been involved in a genuine relationship with a woman who was, you know, 10 years older than me, that somehow I failed at. And it didn't dawn on me that it wasn't me failing in a relationship. There was no relationship to fail. And so when I had that realization that, wait, I was a victim, and I know men don't like to use the V word, you know, we're never victims. You're not allowed to say victim. But to acknowledge that point was the point where I was like, this needs to be stated, even if it's just for my own personal relief. And if one person picks up this book and can learn something from it, then I've done my part in this world.
Now, you said something right there that stood out to me, and it's something that we have conversated in the past about, and that is the whole idea of how society is framing this, how society will frame something like yeah. your experience, as you are the one, you're the victim, and your abuser was an older woman.
Yeah.
On top of that, it was someone that as kids, we put all our trust in,
right.
which would be a teacher.
Right.
In your book, you had a quote, and if I'm correct, it was the court officer.
Yes.
That said, I bet you weren't complaining then.
Yes.
How damaging is that when you hear?
You don't, you know, no one's coming to help you. right? And so you're stuck in this situation where if I express how I feel, I'm ungrateful somehow for feeling the way that I do. And inevitably, we all do. One of the things recently, we had done a study on male abuse survivors. And these were all men who have been in very similar situations as me, okay? So what we've come to find was that all of these unprocessed feelings, right? Depression, anxiety, you know, sexual insecurity, incarceration and addiction, self-medication. These are all byproducts of being involved in these relationships. But when you don't have someone that you can go to, like I was saying about my colleague, who's just going to tell you she's making a man out of you, it's minimized. So when your pain is minimized, that immediately puts you in a position where then there's something wrong with me. I'm the crazy one. And you carry that burden of just feeling crazy. Like there's no help. There's something wrong with you for having felt that you were compromised in some way.
And I want to transition into the kind of like the meat of your book, but I want to approach it with care because, you know, this is a sensitive subject matter. And the details that you wrote about in your book is very dark, and it does get, you know, there is triggers that needs to be done within that. And for people who don't know, never heard of Das Krista, what's the story behind the book?
So it's a story of how you become a victim, right? How the layers of failure that have to take place from other adults that leave a child vulnerable to a predator. Right. And how cunning and careful and selective these predators are in their prey. It's no different than you see, you know, in on the savannah when a lion seeks out the slowest antelope. You know, they find the one that is the easiest to manipulate. So I didn't have a home structure. Right? I didn't have people who were going to report any wrongdoing. You know, I was older looking enough that I could pass in certain circles. I was intelligent enough to be able to pass off as someone that was learning. And the main purpose of the story, though, is to how did you become a victim of a child predator? What are the signs that someone is the victim of a child predator and how we should really actually try to create safe spaces for when we see these things happening, because a lot of people witnessed what happened and they did nothing because they were congratulating me. And that's what is still so mind blowing to me, is that this congratulations you get when you're a young boy with an older woman, and that's acceptable in some people's minds.
It is. And you see more of it. You know, like I said, I remember being in high school, and there, you know, there were even the small little talks of, oh, this may be something that's happening. And if it was, you know, they are bigging up, the guy for, oh my God, like you are doing this, not realizing it's wrong on all levels.
The contribution that it does to your psyche, right? The one thing I didn't realize until I was older is, and this is something that was expressed in another show that I was on, I thought I was living an adult life, but I was 15, 16 years old, okay? Think about the amount of insecurity you have when you're with a woman that you can't provide anything for because you can't work. And then you see other men who have cars, who have careers, who have influence and money and can do things that you can't. And you're always looking over your shoulder for the better person to take over. So I was already predispositioned for insecurity before I even got a chance to live a life as an adult. I was never going to be equal to the other men that I was surrounded by, but I have no business being surrounded by them. I should have been surrounded by teenagers.
Right.
So my comparison was never to my peers. It was always to these other more established figures that I was surrounded by because of the relationship that I was in.
And also, you know, within that book, you do dive into the comparison that she had with her father,
Yes.
Like,
yeah,
you know.
Herps, yeah. Trying to create a father. Like, I was, you know, I use the Build-A-Bear analogy, but I don't, you know, that's sort of like she was trying to recreate from scratch the man that she actually wanted. And so it's hard, since you can't necessarily find that, mm-hmm. why not create it, right? Here, you're gonna dress this way, and you're gonna wear this cologne, and you're gonna talk this way, and you're gonna have this job, and here's what I want you to do. For, like, building your man from scratch is what she was doing from the ground up.
And that kind of leans into the whole grooming process. Mm-hmm. So for people who are not familiar with that process, can you take us through those steps of the grooming?
Right. I lay it out in the book, but I use my example more specifically than the example I gave in the book. I hadn't had a birthday cake since I was like 9 years old. And that day was a pretty rough day, the last time I got one from my parents, okay? And she knew that story. So 15th birthday, I walk into study hall, guess who has a birthday cake for me? You know? And it's those things, right? Like, hey, here's this for you. And now here's a little extra privilege. So listen, you don't have to worry about coming to class this day. You know, you can go home early. Do you need a ride home? I see you're walking. Oh, look at your shoes. Let me take you to get it. Like, it's those little, doing these little things for you, gradually ingratiating you, making you more comfortable, feeling more welcome to be around this individual.
Mm-hmm.
So when I was at her apartment, it was normal to be there. When she asked me to rub her shoulders, it was normal to do that. When we were watching movies and holding hands, it was normal, because these things have been slowly progressed into that point of it's not one moment where, hey, I'm your teacher and the rock music plays and she throws her glasses off and you're going at it on the desk.
Yeah.
Like that's the fantasies, you know, version of sort of what this is. It's a much more deliberate probing process to check safeguards. I can keep you out a little later. I can pick you up a little closer to home. I can buy you a little extra thing here and there. I can call you, you know, and then eventually you're in their grasp.
And then the next series of events led you after you graduated.
Yes.
The next series of events led you to being incarcerated.
Yes.
And this is all because you have phased out.
Yes.
When all this was happening, take me through, and like I said, I want to be, you know, the process, like your mental state of mind when it was now she's phasing you out.
So it started with little things, right? Like, hey, I have a friend who I think you might like. You know, oh, hey, don't you think, what about this girl? Do you think this is somebody you want to hang out with? Leaving me at the bar by myself, you know? And it's like, well, you don't want me anymore. So what's wrong with me? Right. You know what? And that's what it never comes back to. Oh, well, 18 now and she likes him younger. So, you know, it was more so what's wrong with me? And when you try to constantly self-evaluate that way, right? Like, what's wrong with me? Why would anyone else want me? And then it just became trying to prove that I was desirable, you know, constantly trying to prove that by being involved in multiple, you know, illicit situations with other women to try to prove that to be the case. But the more she kept trying to push me away, the more difficult it was for me to comprehend my own ability to live my own life, because I'd been so dependent on her for everything. Like, I didn't know how to, it's not like she actually taught me anything in life, right? Like, I didn't know how to pay bills or go get a car or balance a checkbook. None of those things were ever actually learned in that process. But I was more so addicted to the comfort level of the dependency on her support and not knowing how to live without it. And once that support started to be stripped away, the more I tried to cling to it. And, you know, I think for her own safety, one, like you said, the aging out thing, but two, because at some point it has to get real, right?
Yeah.
There was an ultimatum. We're either going to be in a relationship or not, you know, like we can't, mm-hmm. how long are we going to continue to hide? Is it 60? You
right.
know? So I think the reality of what she had done eventually started to creep upon her too. And now she was trying to get me to move on quietly so she could, you know, throw that skeleton in her closet and move on with her life.
Because there was points in the book where, you know, even while you were still in school, there was the let's cover it up.
Cover it up,
and let's, you know, do this. But then there was points where maybe the jealousy started to appear.
She wanted me to go, but never wanted me to leave.
Yeah.
And the same thing happened as when I was older. Like, she would want me to go on these dates and be around these other women. But then when I did, she would get jealous and pull me back in. And so there was this tug of war that was happening too. She wanted to keep the secret relationship and wanted me to have a real relationship superficially that we could, so she could still have the best of both worlds.
And during that time of towards the phasing out of it, you were warned.
Yes.
As far as what can happen if you continued.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, I can only imagine, because me being a male that probably has been through a situation where you are subject to, you know, just wanting to fight for what you think is love. And, right. You know, they say love makes you do
crazy
things. And you went through something where that did put you, you know, behind bars.
Yes.
And then that did put you, like we had spoke earlier, you are sitting there trying to plead your case.
Yeah.
And tell these people this is what's wrong, and no one heard you.
So one of the things I learned earlier was early on, especially during this experience, was passive racism and how race played a gigantic part in what happened.
Mm-hmm.
You know, obviously my abuser was not of the same race as me. She was a Caucasian woman. Her family heavily ingratiated within the court system. And the person that you spoke of was a high ranking law enforcement officer and officer of the court that warned me, but I wasn't the one that should have gotten the warning.
Exactly.
You know, and so that's how this all, like, when I started to see these things play out, right? Like, I'm standing in court with an army of people behind me that have all at some point committed any number of felonies and you know, child abuse acts, playing victim in court, you know, and there I was, the scary figure, you know, like, I'm a big person, so it's easy to make me appear to be more terrifying in that situation, you know, being in jail with no money. So, you know, my hair is nappy. I don't smell so great. You know, I look crazy already. My beard's all over the place. And so it was easy to paint that picture of me, you know, in the court. And when you're trying to voice these things and say these things aloud, there's so much to say that I ended up rambling a bunch of nonsense in court and made myself look even worse. So, and I'm smiling about it now because I can look back on it, like, I take it for what it was. It taught me a lot about how the justice system, and I'm using quotes to say that, actually works, because there was no justice served that day. But it gave me something that I'll never, ever, ever take for granted. And that was a strength and a resolve that I didn't even know I had at that time. But, you know, in that moment, I had a choice, and I think I made the right one.
And in that moment of being incarcerated and then getting out, if I'm correct, you did join the military
after. This was after I got out of the military. I was incarcerated.
Okay. And then there's the pivot moment. Mm-hmm. You know, this is a trigger, because this moment right here is a trigger for most listeners, where you were in your house and had a weapon on you.
Yes.
And was contemplating taking your life.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Someone who we both wish was wish was here was on the phone with you when you were contemplating this.
Yeah.
Take me through that moment. Because I feel like that moment right there was the the shift for you?
It was one of the major shifts, absolutely. One of several to come. Self-medication. All right. I couldn't stop drinking. And I used to think that helped me. I thought it would help me sleep. And then I started smoking and drinking. I thought that would help me sleep even better. And the sleep never came. And when you are awake 19, 20, 22 hours a day, and you have nothing to do because you have no job, you live in your own head. And I just couldn't escape the fact that, what did I do wrong, right? What was so wrong? What's so terrible about me that this person doesn't want me, right? I'm unwantable. Parents didn't want me. Family don't, you know. You start looking at all these things that, why is it that I am this person that no one seems to want to be around? Like, why is it that I can't seem to keep a job or make money or have these nice things? I'm sitting in this, you know, crappy little bedroom with old sneakers on and hand-me-down pants trying to figure out what to do with myself. And the world would be better off without me. You know, I'm just taking up space. And that's what the thought was. Like, I'm just taking up space. And with every sip, the idea became more acceptable to just want to go to sleep, you know, and no one's going to miss me anyway. And, you know, what's the point? And these are all the things that are thinking. And so you put bullet one in and spin the chamber and stare at it and then take it out and take another sip and do it again and repeat. And I don't know what made me pick up that ugly cordless phone. For those of you who are, you know, not 114 years old, we had phones that, you know, were attached to our houses still. I didn't have a cell phone then, but I had a cordless phone, and I decided to call Carl to say goodbye, because that was the one person who I knew I would want to say goodbye to. And I didn't explicitly say goodbye, mm-hmm. but I remember just having a conversation about reminiscing about basketball and, you know, just saying how badly I wanted to go to sleep. And I hung up the phone, sat there for another 10 minutes, and I remember sticking the barrel under my chin and then my temple and then my chin. And then, you know, I was just wishing I could have the nerve to pull the trigger. And when I couldn't, there was a window hanging right by the desk that I was sitting at, and I just tossed the revolver out the window. And I swear, as soon as the metal hit the dumpster beneath me, the door got kicked in, and it was Buffalo police to come, and they came and took me.
And that's because
Carl had called the police.
Carl knew, mm-hmm. and he can tell that there was a cry for help.
Yeah.
And a lot of individuals would not have done that. You know, I think back to, I was a kid at the time when my stepbrother took his life.
I'm sorry. Wow.
And it's one of those things where we didn't know, obviously. Yeah. But I always think back to, like, what if, you know, and you are the example of, like, what if you did make that call, because some people, it's that just, I just need that hand.
So there is a misconception about what depression looks like. And everyone thinks it's like you just walk around sad in a robe all day and you don't shave. And that's not what depression looks like. It has so many different faces. And I think what this month needs to really do is to start to highlight what male depression actually looks like. You know, rage moments, hypersexuality, you know, constantly trying to prove yourself, you know, frustration and anxiety, lack of sleep, you know, substance abuse. Like, these things are all manifestations of what actual depression looks like. And a lot of people around me didn't notice the depression because I was still good at making jokes. Like, if you're not sad all the time, then people don't think you're depressed. And I think that's the one stigma that we can do for this month, is to remove that from the lexicon, right? The imagery of depression, which is the sad face. That is not what depression actually is. And the signs are there for a lot of these men. The 38,428 men who took their lives last year all at some point exhibited those signs. And I think that we need to become more aware and reach out, because how often have legitimately in our lives, all of us, besides winning something, right, or celebrating, how often have we gotten a hug from another man?
That's a good question, because I'm thinking about it myself. I mean,
are you okay? you know, like those
right,
words, right?
Right. Yeah. And that's something that I kind of tell a lot of my friends. Those three words,
yeah,
go far. Yeah. You know, and I'm someone who can pick up on energy a lot. Yeah. So I can, like, if I ask, like, are you okay? And you're like, yeah, I'm good. I can feel
right, that you're not.
And
right.
And then it's like, okay, but then I never want to let that person know. Like, I always want to let that person know that I'm here.
Yeah.
You know, earlier this year, I had a friend, more like a mentee, who went back home and reached out to me. And, you know, I checked on him because I haven't heard from him in a while. Right. And I asked him, like, hey, like, how's everything going? And he was like, I just got out of the hospital. Like, I had to get admitted into the hospital because I was going through a lot. And I told him, I said, listen, I don't care what time of day it is.
Yeah.
If you're going through something, call me, yeah, you know, because I know, like, kind of like I felt that toll,
yeah,
when things happen and then everybody's running around just trying to figure out why, or why couldn't they, why didn't I see the signs? Why didn't I reach out more?
Yeah.
You know, and I mean, I'm thinking about, like, what you just asked. When was the last time that I actually hugged a male, other than you when I just seen you
greeting and greeting? Yeah, you know, it's incredible. Right.
It probably was, no, was my brother.
Okay.
You know, it was my brother over the weekend, because, and my nephew, because we had my niece's recitals, and then my niece's birthday party was Sunday.
Okay.
So, happy birthday. You know. But no, but that is a good question, because, you know, you really don't, you know, because we're told to mask that.
Right.
We're never told to express it, because
express it or provide comfort for it, because somehow that is less manly to acknowledge, express and feel, and then to comfort and to provide solution. That is, or even just shut up and listen. You know, another thing too, like the constant need to give advice, you know, like we have Morgan Freeman, we have enough wise men, like let Morgan handle that, guys. You know, the rest of us, like sometimes it's just best to be quiet,
mm-hmm,
and just listen to somebody, what they're saying, you know. And there's a lot of bad advice given, because I watch, you know, I see a lot of these podcasts where, you know, there's a lot of bad advice being given. And but again, these stigmas, right, they have consequences. And this uprising of the manosphere, so to speak, right, because we've demonized some aspects of being a man, or we try to push people to be more expressive. So what we've done is, in that effort, we've overcorrected. We've made people feel like, well, now being a man is toxic. And but even that is not what the intent, you can just take those, you can cut the sentence short, mash those two words together. And now you have this overcorrection of men trying to be extra masculine. So now we end up with the Andrew Tates of the world, right? Where, you know, no, it's not wrong. This is what a man does. This is how a man acts. And you're like, well, really? Because I've never met a man that behaves that way in my life.
Right.
And so now you have this subculture that's created. And so now you have this pushback from from these groups that are trying to overcorrect what we're doing, which is trying to say, it's nothing wrong with being a man, but there's also nothing wrong with shedding tears and providing comfort and being supported and needing support.
We're here with Tuan Williams, author of Dash Krista. We'll be back with more What's Next after this from Buffalo Toronto Public Media, NPR.
Public media starts here, in our neighborhoods, our schools, our city halls, where decisions meet real life. BTPM NPR's local reporters are asking the questions that matter, listening to the people affected, and explaining what it all means for our region.
There's a lot of poor record keeping. There are records that lists that don't reconcile with other lists. There's a lot of gasoline that's being used that isn't properly accounted for. And there are a lot of people with take-home vehicles.
That's Erie County Comptroller Kevin Hardwick. He's outlining just a few of the issues his office found when conducting an audit of the county's vehicle fleet.
From paper trails to public impact, this is journalism that stays with the story and with the community it serves. Buffalo Toronto Public Media, NPR, produces journalism with depth, care, and purpose. This is Public Media.
What is BTPM Plus? It's an evolution of Buffalo Toronto Public Media that brings you the best of PBS, where you can watch your favorite programs live and dig into collections curated just for you. And here's the best part. When you stream BTPM Plus, you're not just watching, you're supporting your local public media station, the journalism, the arts, and the storytelling that keeps our community connected. Visit btpm.org/plus today. Stream smarter, stream local.
Buffalo Toronto Public Media The Bridge, made by music lovers and powered by listener support. Locally owned and operated, always independent. This is Public Media.
You're listening to What's Next, our place to discuss the important issues facing the communities of Western New York and Southern Ontario. We want to hear from you. Click on the Talk to Us option in the BTPM app, and we'll work to get your questions or comments on the air. Do you have a story or concern we should be addressing? Email us at whatsnext@btpm.org. Together, we'll have the conversations that matter. This is Buffalo Toronto Public Media, NPR.
Today's conversation includes discussion of sexual abuse, grooming, trauma, and suicide. If you need support, call or text 988 for the Suicide and Crisis Lifeline or contact the Rain National Sexual Assault Hotline at 800-656-4673. Welcome back to What's Next. I'm your host, Charles Gilbert. We're here with TJ Williams, author of Dash Krista, which I've been saying it, and I know the listeners are probably sitting there trying to figure out, what does Dash Krista mean? So for the listening audience, who probably is sitting there trying to figure out, like I said, what is the meaning of that word?
So my abuser was Irish, and Dash Krista is Gaelic for indestructible, unbreakable. And that's what I had to prove to be in order to overcome what happened. You know, I couldn't be crushed by the weight of what transpired, and to rise from that and to even have a semblance of a decent life where most people don't, you know, I don't take that for granted. So, and I try to pass that on to anyone who's willing to listen.
So with that being said, with you given the meaning behind it, let's go through that journey, that healing journey.
Okay.
Because, you know, we just got from a dark place, mm-hmm. you know, the darkest moment, to now the process in you getting to where you are now.
Yeah.
I remember you mentioning in the book, I believe, your daughter.
Yes.
And the question that she asked you that we had a conversation about, because I said that during your book signing that I attended, when you said what you said, it struck a nerve to me because I'm a girl dad.
Yeah.
And you said that she asked you, why do you hate yourself?
Yeah.
And I feel like that to me was that moment next to Carl, this moment also helped you change and pivot and start that healing journey.
Yeah. She asked me that at 5 years old. And I know, even when we talked about it later on, she still doesn't remember why she asked it, but that's okay. But I did ask her again why she asked me that. But it was obvious, it was written all over me, right? Like, why are you so self-loathing? And this was something that was asked of me again and when I was in rehab, which is, how come you're the only person who can't see what you have to offer? You know, you walk into a room and, you know, people gravitate towards you. So why is it that you can't recognize that? What is it about you that you despise yourself so much? And it stems back from that. I had to really look back as why, right? Was I doing anything to benefit myself? Was I doing anything to benefit this world? Was I using any skills or knowledge that I have? Was I actually living the life that I wanted to or was intended to live? And the answer was no. I was sitting in a basement in the dark, smoking weed, hating myself. And what good did I do? What was I actually accomplishing? And I had a child. And that was not the first, that moment was actually from another fall from grace after I'd already overcome all this and made a bunch of money and made a life for myself. And I just couldn't sustain. So understanding why I had trouble sustaining life, why is it that I couldn't function as an adult? You know, because I was trapped in this 15-year-old mindset. The pause button had been hit the moment that I slept with that woman in that home. And I was stuck there. I was still stuck in that living room, a scared kid, not sure of himself, directionless and not knowing what to do. And that's all I saw when I looked in the mirror. So to correct that, I had to undo that, right? I had to grow up and start doing grown-up things. And one was taking care of my appearance and my well-being. So, you know, sobriety didn't mean just giving up, you know, substance abuse. Sobriety meant like actually doing sober things, like making conscious choices. You know, I always equate it to having to walk, but telling yourself left foot down, right foot up, right foot down, you know, mm-hmm. And that's what it has to be for a while. Like you have to rewire your entire thought process to be very deliberate in everything that you do, you know, and it started with that, like just making sure that I was making sound choices.
And also through that, you found your partner, your writer who is sitting right here. Obviously, I feel though as if she also was a very important part of this whole rehab or, you know, you being who you are now, healing journey.
There's some things you're not ready to recognize when you're in a particular mindset, right? Mm-hmm. Like you might say you can't see the forest from the trees. You know, if I had run into Tiana 3 years prior, I would have walked right past her, right? Because I would have found the tragic figure that was just as messed up as me to put myself in a bad situation, to have a bunch of misery and make a bunch of excuses and then, you know, find a reason to run away. And that was the vicious cycle I was in, right? To find the person who I was somehow better than. And this was the first time I'd actually tried to participate in a relationship with someone that was better than me. You know, that was complete already, that didn't need me to save her and I couldn't use that as a mechanism to escape. Mm-hmm. You know, like, so yeah, another tipping point was being able to find somebody that had her own internal support and was unbreakable herself. And, you know, sometimes those forces collide in a way that can be destructive, and other times they can shift in a way that is a very beautiful thing to witness.
During the healing process, what part of it was the hardest for you? Acknowledging what happened, being honest, regaining your identity, finding peace, or living with intention?
The honesty part. You're taught, as I said, I was groomed not only to be a boyfriend or a Stepford husband, so to speak, but I was also groomed to be a liar. to not tell the truth, to suppress, to, and especially when you're in a situation with someone where you can't possibly have an honest conversation with anybody, no matter what you're feeling that day. Can you imagine what it's like to have a fight with your girlfriend, but no one knows you have a girlfriend? You can't talk about your girlfriend, and you're having this bad day that no one seems to understand. So you have to make something up as to why you feel the way that you do.
Mm-hmm.
Or you're going somewhere, but you can't say where you're going. Or you have money, and you can't say why where you got it. Or you're doing things that make no sense, and you have these things that are appearing out of thin air. And so it was that part, learning that it's okay to say, this is what I'm doing, this is what happened. You know, and so that step leads to everything else being possible. But if you can't make, and honesty isn't just external, it's looking at yourself, looking in the mirror and saying, I did this or I do this, but without being self-deprecating to the point where you're unredeemable. I did this, so how can I do better next time?
Now, some people will say that, you know, this could be shame.
Mm-hmm.
What does it mean for a man to acknowledge what happened when that shame has told him to stay quiet? Because, you know, most times we, when something like this happens, especially because we rarely hear of men being victims.
Yeah.
How do they acknowledge that?
Acknowledgement starts with just that, saying it out loud. You know, I had to say it to myself and then say it out loud. I was the victim of a child predator. And when you understand and you say those words out loud, the relief, you didn't do anything. And that's what we have to understand. Like, it's not your fault. You didn't do this to yourself. You didn't say, you know what, I want, you know, I just want to be the victim of a predator today. Where can I find a predator? You know, that didn't happen. And when you're a child, we put as men, we don't allow young boys to be boys, to grow into men. We are always trying to transition from infant to man almost instantaneously. There was a story of a football player that he was punching his son in the chest saying, man up. The boy was four. How is a four-year-old going to man up?
Right.
You know, and so it's that problem, too, is that we take on such a huge responsibility at such an early age to be a certain way that acknowledgement is impossible because you're supposed to know better. You're supposed to be stronger than that. You're supposed to man up when you're 10, 11, 12, 13 years old. A 15-year-old can't man up.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's what we have to remove from the thought process. And so to acknowledge that you are a child, you are not in the position to know better. You know how much smarter I am than a 15-year-old? <You know? laughs> Like the levels of distance of knowledge and experience that were gained from 25 to 35, 35 to 45 are astronomical.
Yeah.
And so you have to appreciate the gap in experience and knowledge that you had from your abuser. And it's okay to accept the fact that you were a child. Children need to learn. And it's a lesson that none of us should have to learn. But you were not in control. And the things that you can control, you should. And that's why, as I said, the serenity prayer is always something that I keep close to me, you know, because I had to learn to accept the things I couldn't change, you know, and that was the biggest difference. And once you acknowledge again, I was a child.
We're winding down to our last few moments here, but I do want to get into where people can get the book if they're interested in it. But one of the last questions that I have for you would be, how do we create space for men to be honest without turning their pain into shame? Piggybacking off of...
Yeah. It takes a village. One of the things that we, you know, I was going to say this before, and, you know, part of one of the steps about honesty, it isn't just you that needs to be honest. It isn't just external honesty. It's in the integrity of another man to also know that these are things you feel,
mm-hmm.
to understand your own humanity in the moment. And a lot of us tend to try to take that opportunity to get one up on the next man in front of us, right? So instead of, if you come to me and say, listen, I'm feeling a certain way, oh man, I don't do that. You know, I'm way more manly than your manliness can man.
Right.
And so if we stop doing that to each other and really just acknowledge our own internal humanity, you know, it'll start to create itself. Because again, you see these pontiffs, they go on their podcast and they go on TV and they say all this nonsense. And then they go home and they probably cry and eat pudding and watch Lifetime movies too. And it's okay. I love a good cry watching a movie. You know, right. I watch stuff all the time. We sit together bawling our eyes out. You see that? Yeah. It's okay. It's normal. And to start normalizing mm-hmm. the things that we have within us all is where we need to start.
Yeah. I just had a good cry over the weekend. You know, I'm binge watching All American again, so I know it's not really the one, but I find a lot of relatability with Spencer James, okay. which is very ironic that we're sitting here having a conversation about therapy and mental health, because mm-hmm. Spencer also was very big on mental health as well. Mm-hmm. What does Indestructible mean to you today?
It's the same as it's always meant, to be honest with you. It means that it's okay. Indestructible doesn't mean being a piece of granite, right? A stone figure. Mm-hmm. It means that you can allow yourself to feel things and they don't have to destroy you. Like, you can allow yourself to live and fall and to fail and to try to succeed, because that's what being indestructible is. It's not laying down or surrender. And surrender doesn't mean just quitting. Surrender means taking it out on someone else, being violent towards another person, you know, self-harming. Mm-hmm. Those are ways of being destroyed. And if you can manage to understand that, you know, you're going to get back up, that's what being indestructible is. Just get back up no matter what happens.
And for the man listening who knows he's not okay, but doesn't know how to say it, what do you want him to hear?
That you're not alone. You know, and whatever it is, whatever action you're thinking about taking that is going to hurt you or someone else isn't worth that time. It's okay to find someone, no matter who that is, because there's plenty of people in this world who are willing to listen. Tell your story. Don't suffer alone. Don't sit in silence, because silence allows our victimizers to win. They get to live that peace that you don't, and it's what's unfair to you. It's okay to talk.
And what do you hope people take away from reading your book?
That things can happen to you in life and it doesn't have to be the end of your life. That you can actually learn a lot from trials that normally in other circumstances are broken people to pieces. You know, and I know why it does, because I was there, you know, but it's okay. You can pick those up. Every single obstacle that you can throw at a person from the time that I was born was thrown at me, and I'm still here. And so can you.
And I actually, this question in the last time we conversated, I'm actually again, because I think it might have changed. Mm-hmm. If the older you can go back to 15, mm-hmm. 16 year old TJ, what would you say to him?
You know what's funny? I know a lot of us wish that we could go back in time and say things that would, you know, vote, you know, pick this winner and, you know, honestly, I would let him be, because that 15-year-old kid then got to go through something extraordinary. And there's so many parts of my life that I don't talk about in the book, but the butterfly effect is something that I mentioned as one aspect. And every single event, I can talk about this, but I also got to travel the world, meet a lot of great people. I'm talking on this radio program now. I'm an author and a father. So many amazing things came out of something bad it's the rose that grew in concrete. That's mm-hmm. what I feel like, you know? And so my answer has changed because I wouldn't tell him anything. I would just watch him grow.
And if anyone was interested in getting the book, where would they go?
TawanWilliams.com or Amazon or Barnes & Noble or your local bookstores.
TJ, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for this conversation. It was really much needed for all the men out there. You are not alone, like TJ said. This has been What's Next from Buffalo Toronto Public Media, NPR.
Support for the BTPM NPR What's Next podcast comes from Health Foundation for Western and Central New York, partnering with the community to pursue racial and socioeconomic health equity. Learn more at hfwcny.org.